Hi, I'm Brittany Luce, and welcome to Sampler, the show where we play you handpicked moments from podcasts that you just have to hear. So today we're going to talk all about the art of storytelling with Max Linsky. Max is one of the hosts of Longform, a weekly podcast where he and his co-hosts interview writers, editors, podcasters, and other creatives about their work. So Longform is most easily described as an interview show, but it's also part masterclass and part therapy session. I find that whether I'm familiar with the guest or not, I walk away from every episode with some type of wisdom, whether it be journalistic or otherwise. So I figured, you know, why not try to share some of that with you guys? Oh, so one more thing before we get on with today's show. This episode contains some adult language and themes. So before we get started, now would be a good time to send your kids out of the room or put some earbuds on yourself. Okay, so let's get started. So I wanted to have Max on the show because Longform is like my comfort listening. It's like my Cheez-Its, but it also has the nutritional value of like kale.
kale-flavored Cheez-Its.
Yeah, like kale-flavored Cheez-Its, except that taste regular, but have a lot of vitamin A.
Okay.
If ever I don't really know what I want to listen to, definitely if I'm on a plane or in an airport, I am listening to Longform.
It's funny that you say that because I think my favorite moment in the whole show is about airports.
Really? What moment?
I did this interview with George Saunders.
Uh-huh.
And basically, like, the first half of that interview, I was, like, asking him about, like, writing and the normal things we ask him about. And then something clicked in my brain, and I was like, okay, I'm right now in this small room with George Saunders. I'm probably never going to be in a small room with George Saunders ever again. This is basically, like, the wisest person I know. And so at some point, I just kind of stopped asking writing questions and just started being like, please, like, teach me your ways, George Saunders. I asked him a question that was like, basically, what's the meaning of life? Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And
life there.
Yeah. And he had this amazing explanation.
You know, when you're saying goodbye to somebody at the airport that you love and you get all soft, you're like, oh, my God, I hardly knew you. You know, that kind of feeling. What if that's the truth, that mode is the mode? That times 10, you know, maybe is the mode that we should exist in all the time. Then another day you're just yourself, you know. There's a big gap between those two people. So how much time did I spend in that regular old stupid habitual mindset of taking everything for granted as opposed to this exalted state of being super tenderized to the people you care about? And I'm guessing that, you know, if there's a heaven, it's that at the airport times 10 or 20 or 1,000.
Damn, that's beautiful.
I fucking George Saunders.
Yeah. One of the things I like about your interview style is that you seem like you're really connecting with the other person. Like, you definitely come prepared, but you also seem really open to, like, examining whatever it is that they bring you.
I used to go in with, like, a list of 1,000 questions. I would spend so much time before interviews, like, coming up with questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then those interviews sucked.
Really?
Yeah. Because I would just sit there and people would say, like, and that's when I knew I didn't like my mother. And I would just be like, and then in 1972, you went to this place for college. Like, I wouldn't listen at all. The whole point was just to, like, tick off all the questions on my list, which were just questions I'd come up with before I met the person.
Yeah.
Those are shit questions for the most part.
Why are they shit questions?
Because it's just what you assume about them, right? One of the great things about doing the show, one of the funnest things about doing the show is, like, most of the people that I've talked to are people that I, like, admire.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically like a fanboy show, you know? It's gotten better, I think. The early episodes were, like, straight Chris Farley show. Do you remember that sketch on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah. Welcome to the Chris Farley Show. I'm Chris Farley, and my guest tonight is one of the greatest musicians ever, Paul McCartney. Well, it's great to be here.
You remember when
you were with the Beatles?
Yeah, sure.
That was awesome.
I was basically doing a Chris Farley impression for the first, like, many, many shows. The first one I did was with David Gran in the offices of The New Yorker, which is, like, gives you some insight into my hubris. It's like, the first interview I'm ever going to do for a podcast is with David fucking Gran. And basically the whole interview is just me being like, do you remember that time in that story where the guy, he thought he was dead, but he wasn't dead? Do you remember that? And he was like, yeah. Yeah, I remember that. I was like, that was awesome. You know, it's terrible.
How did you get out of that?
I don't know. You do enough of them and like you get like a little bit better at it, I guess, mm-hmm. just like by sheer practice. But also I realized that like it wasn't good.
So in addition to the way that you ask questions, one of the things that I like about your show, but also just like about podcasting in general, is that it gives you this chance to kind of like get really deep into stories. The same way that on long form, you talk to people who wrote something that really affected you or wrote something that shaped the way that you see the world, you get to ask them how they did it. So I want to turn actually to the clips that I'm going to be playing for you. Kind of working within the theme of getting really deep into a story, we can get started with our first clip. It comes to us from a podcast miniseries actually called What the Hell Happened in East New York. So for those who don't know, East New York is a neighborhood in Eastern Brooklyn, which is a borough of New York City. And this miniseries gets into why that neighborhood has become so dangerous and neglected. It's hosted by this guy, Alexander Abnos, but the series itself actually follows this journalist, Kevin Heldman. So I want to play this clip for you because in this particular moment, Alexander gets into how Kevin got started as a journalist, and it reminded me of a lot of the conversations that you have on your show. So the first voice you're going to hear is Alexander Abnos.
So how did it come to be that you became a journalist?
I came from a really hellish, crazy, abusive, sick family. I was in trouble as a teenager, so, you know, living on the streets, homeless, so I had nothing. And one thing I had was school. I was smart, and I'm not smart, arrogant. I liked teachers. Most smart guys back then hated the female teachers. They tried to challenge them, embarrass them. I loved the female teachers. It was like, be my mom, take me away. You don't know what's going on in there. And I actually told them, a famous story is when I was in kindergarten, I went to Mrs. Leaf, my kindergarten teacher, and I knew damn well why I was doing it. It's not like kids say the darndest thing. I was intentionally saying it. I was 5 years old. Mrs. Leaf, my father said the other day that he's going to pick up a chair and hit my mother over the head with it. She told my mother in parent conference and told her, he said that. And my mother couldn't, I don't know, maybe she did deny it. She lies all the time, but she actually did say that. So I was saying it because I wanted them to know that this is wrong. Yeah, it was China. So that was early journalism. And that's what I was, every piece, broken family, bad teenager, drugs, depression, running wild, cutting school, cutting myself, you know, just put in a, I was in another facility for a year, got kicked out for bad behavior and put in a Phoenix house, which was hardcore, and eventually joined the Army when I was 18. Did 2 years in the Army, got out, pursued my earlier writing ambitions in college, went to Columbia Journalism School, and journalist ever since 91.
And you've gone back to the same kind of stories again and again.
My type of journalism is like, it's like substitute for life kind of, morality, my thing, religion for me, so I use it. I can't just do like fun stuff with journalism or like just make money or just to watch movies. Sometimes I'm in the mood for a comedy. Sometimes I'm in the mood for a drama. Sometimes I want to see heavy documentary. It's not like that for me with journalism. You know, so I have to do like important, significant, like worthwhile of things that are of value, make a contribution actually.
Sounds like it'd be a good podcast interview.
So a lot of the journalists who you interview on your show have these like wildly different paths into that career. Like some people, like the guy from the clip, went to Columbia J School, you know? And other people wrote for their paper at Dartmouth. And other people wrote for the internet, and maybe someone found their blog. But it seems like what makes a person a journalist is less like training sometimes and more like a certain set of like skills or like a way that you see the world or the way that you think about things.
Yeah, I mean, a thing that comes up all the time is curiosity. That's like the number one recurring theme, I think. It's like when you ask people that question, basically, mm-hmm. like, why are you a journalist or why do you do this? Their answer overwhelmingly, no matter what that path was, mm-hmm. is that they're curious and they follow their curiosity. And this is a job that allows you to do that.
Even like I kind of struggle with whether or not I'm a journalist.
What do you think?
I don't know.
Does it matter?
I don't know. I think there's some like legitimacy to it. Like I didn't And this is like a pattern that I hear come up on long form a lot. But like, I don't know that I ever had any formal training.
It's not something that necessarily need to go to school for a bunch of years. The way you learn how to do it is by doing it for the most part. Another thing that's come up a lot in the path part of the conversations is the journalism industry is changing so much in bad ways.
How do you mean?
My first job was in 2004, and it was at the Alt Weekly in Tampa Bay, Florida. I had to write a 5,000-word story every month. There were these fantastic editors who'd been doing it for a long time who would, like, sit with me, teach me how to do it. It was great. It was like journalism school, except I got paid to do it. So there was this path 12 years ago where you could go to a place and learn how to do this and someone would pay you to do that. There are far, far fewer of those jobs now than there were before. Like, I don't know what you do if you are a young, aspiring journalist in 2016.
What's the best story anybody's told you about how they got started?
Tell you what's not the best story. There is one aspect of the, like, the path conversation that's gotten boring, which is a lot of the people who come on the show. The answer to that question is, I went to a good college. I came out of college without any debt. I knew someone who knew someone. I got an internship. I worked for a while for no money. And then eventually I got a job. And that story's boring too. So like on the episodes where there isn't the path conversation, oftentimes it's because it's that and we've had it a million times.
Okay, we're going to actually take a short break. And when we get back, more podcast storytelling. We are back. Sampler, Max Linsky, long form, doing it big.
Doing it big.
Doing it big.
That's our slogan.
2016. You forgot the, I always like to add the year onto any one of my personal slogans. So we're going to move on to the next clip. Are you
Great.
Ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, so this one comes from Modern Love. So Modern Love is a column in the New York Times. Is about all types of love and all types of relationships. But it's also now a podcast from WBUR hosted by Meghna Chakrabarty. So on the podcast, they actually have written columns that are read by actors, followed by an interview with the person who actually wrote the piece. In this episode, the actor that's reading is Connie Britton, and she is reading an essay by a woman named Elizabeth Fitzsimons. And I should warn, it's a pretty emotional story. It's about her going to China to adopt a child.
I saw the scar the first time I changed Natalie's diaper, just an hour after the orphanage director handed her to me in a hotel banquet room in Nanchang, a provincial capital in southeastern China. Despite the high heat and humidity, her caretakers had dressed her in two layers. And when I peeled back her sweaty clothes, I found the worst diaper rash I'd ever seen, and a 2-inch scar at the base of her spine, cutting through the red bumps and peeling skin. The next day, when the Chinese government would complete the adoption, was also Natalie's first birthday. We had a party for her that night, attended by families we'd met and representatives of the adoption agency, and Natalie licked cake frosting from my finger. But we worried about a rattle in her chest, and there was the scar. So afterward, my husband Matt asked our adoption agency to send the doctor. After listening to Natalie's chest, he said she had bronchitis. Then he turned her over and looked at the scar. Frowning, he asked for a cotton swab and soap. He coated an end in soap and probed her sphincter, which he then said was loose. He suspected she'd had a tumor removed and wondered aloud if she had spina bifida before finally saying that she would need to be seen at the hospital. Two taxis took us all there, and as we waited to hear news, I tried to think positive thoughts of the room we had painted for Natalie in light yellow, and the crib with Winnie the Pooh sheets. But my mind shifted when I saw one of the women from the agency in a heated exchange in Chinese with the doctors, then with someone on her cell phone. We pleaded with her for information. A CT scan confirmed that there had been a tumor that someone, somewhere, had removed. It had been a sloppy job. Nerves were damaged, and as Natalie grew, her condition would worsen, eventually leaving her paralyzed from the waist down. Control over her bladder and bowels would go too. Yes, she had a form of spina bifida, as well as a cyst on her spine. I looked at my husband in shock, waiting for him to tell me that I had misunderstood everything. But he only shook his head. I held on to him and cried into his chest, angry that creating a family seemed so impossible for us, and that life had already been so difficult for Natalie. Back at the hotel, we hounded the women from the agency. Why wasn't this in her medical report? How could a scar that size not be noticed? It was 2 inches long, for God's sake. They shook their heads, shrugged, apologized. And then they offered a way to make it better. In cases like these, we can make a rematch with another baby, the one in charge said. The rest of the process would be expedited and we would go home on schedule. We would simply leave with a different girl. Months before, we had been presented with forms asking which disabilities would be acceptable in a prospective adoptee. What, in other words, did we think we could handle? HIV? Hepatitis? Blindness? We checked off a few mild problems that we knew could be swiftly corrected with proper medical care. As Matt had written on our application, this will be our first child, and we feel we would need more experience to handle anything more serious. Now, we faced surgeries, wheelchairs, colostomy bags. I envisioned our home in San Diego with ramps leading to the doors. I saw our lives as being utterly devoted to her care. How would we ever manage? Yet how could we leave her? Had I given birth to a child with these conditions, I wouldn't have left her in the hospital. Though a friend would later say, well, that's different, it wasn't to me. I knew this was my test, my life's worth distilled into a moment. I was shaking my head no before they finished explaining. We didn't want another baby, I told them. We wanted our baby, the one sleeping right over there. She's our daughter, I said. We love her.
Oof. Man. That was hard to listen to. But we can talk about it. It was a really strong narrative. And it was Mrs. Coach, so that's cool.
Oh, Mrs. Coach from that show? I don't watch it.
Friday Night Lights.
Friday Night Lights. I know her as the woman with the really nice hair from Nashville.
Yeah, one and the same.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes on your show, you ask people about things that are really hard. Sometimes you even will say that you are afraid to ask them the thing before you ask them the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
How do you get over the hump? Because there are questions that you could easily not ask somebody when you get face to face with them. You decide they're too invasive. You decide they're too difficult.
I find it hard, whether it's on the podcast or in life, to not ask those questions. And it doesn't always work out. You know, sometimes it is invasive. Like sometimes it's actually like, you actually shouldn't ask that question, both on the show and in real life. Usually there's like a long preamble and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm nervous about it. It's hard to ask those questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I often like wish that I didn't have to do the whole preamble. Those questions might be better if you just ask them. But I really want to know, you know? And sometimes people don't. I mean, sometimes people try and answer and can't. And mm-hmm. sometimes people say, I don't want to answer that. But if you really want to know, if you genuinely care mm-hmm. about the answer, in my experience, is whether or not they're microphones, people will talk about it. You know, people want to talk about hard stuff if they think they're talking to someone who's listening.
Have you guys ever thought about having people read some of their stories on the show?
Yes. One of the original ideas, or one of the first ideas we had, was that that would be the show, was that people would come on and read their magazine article. And then, like, we'd ask them questions about it. Uh-huh. And then we had another idea where people would read the magazine article, and then you just, like, interrupt them and be like, wait, what just happened there? And both of those ideas were terrible. particularly the second one. But What I have found is that oftentimes the medium that you intended to tell a story in is the best medium for that story. So a story that was written for a magazine mm-hmm. might not work that well as audio. Mm-hmm. Maybe it does. Like I listen to audiobooks a lot. And I think the ones that are like heavily produced really work. But we nix that idea in part because also like there are logistics about it. You have to get someone in. Like yeah. reading that kind of stuff is hard. Reading it compellingly
yeah,
is
so
hard.
I guess that's why Modern Love uses actors instead of authors to read their pieces.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think they were smart to not have those writers read them. Yeah. You know, and we started the show with zero money and never expected to make a dollar. So the idea that we were going to like hire an actor to do read an article.
Yeah.
Not going to happen.
Yeah, no. Unless you could pay them in crumbs and pocket lint.
If I could have started a podcast where Mrs. Coach just read things, I would have started that podcast.
Well, we're going to lighten it up.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. So the next clip comes from a podcast miniseries from ESPN. It's called Dunkumentaries, and it's about famous slam dunks in basketball history. So in this clip, you will hear one of the hosts, David Jacoby, and also former NBA player Dee Brown. So Brown is now retired, but he was a member of the Boston Celtics when he made his famous dunk.
You don't have to tell me who Dee Brown is.
Back in 1991.
You can tell other people who Dee Brown is.
Yeah, we all
know. I want to make it clear, you do not need to tell me who Dee Brown is.
Noted.
I wore my Celtic socks yesterday. I had a wireless network called Dee Brown once.
So take it you're a fan?
No, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, well, for the people who are not totally obsessed with Dee Brown, he was an NBA player, and he played for the Celtics, and he got really famous for this amazing dunk that he made in the 1991 slam dunk contest.
Making his first appearance in the Gatorade Slam Dunk Championship, this 6'1".
I wasn't nervous at all because I was the guy nobody thought would win. So there was no pressure on me.
Dee Brown.
Before he even attempted a dunk, it was clear Dee was different.
Oh, he's pumping his shoes up.
Oh, there you go.
If you aren't on Snapchat, you remember this moment. Dee Brown bending down, inflating his Reebok pumps, scoring style points before setting his sights on the rim.
About $1 million doing right there. Another high toss and lob and Rivers jam.
Yes, come on now. Come on.
The best part, Reebok didn't even pay Dee to pump his shoes. They didn't ask him to do it. They didn't suggest he do it. They didn't even know he was going to do it.
Now he's letting the air out.
There you go, right?
At that time, I had a contract with Reebok already, so they didn't tell me to do anything. They didn't tell me to pump my shoes up. That was my idea.
Here's the thing about sports. You can look and act as cool as you want, but none of it matters if you don't win. Dee backed it up with the dunks. By the time he got to the final round, he had already clinched the win. But still, he knew his last dunk had to be special. And honestly, whether he pumped the shoe or not, this contest might be forgotten, if not for his final dunk.
So while I run up there, well, they're not going to know if my eyes are closed, if they're behind me or, you know, it's not on TV.
So he's already started his dunk. He's running toward the basket, and he's still making decisions about exactly what he's going to do.
Kind of was a progression while I was running from just closing my eyes to hand over my eyes to whole arm over my eyes.
The man's a genius. He's not just going to dunk with his eyes closed. He's going to dunk and show you that his eyes are closed. So he tucks his face into the inside of his elbow and then completes the dunk. It was brilliant. It was exciting. It was also the invention of the dad.
Oh my, that's the cherry on the sundae.
25 years later, either we'll be talking about the guy who ran to the side of the backboard or the guy who made the no-look dunk.
The blind dunk.
Of course, he nailed it.
The no-look dunk.
He's been watching the
champions. With the sneakers, with the eyes closed, with the arm over the eyes, unknown Dee Brown took down the dunk contest.
Dee Brown.
Dee Brown.
That was awesome. I've never really heard him talk about it.
I don't really know anything about sports really, but I
That's cool.
loved just like the story. Like, all of the, like, the stories around basketball to me are just so endlessly fascinating. Like, all the shoes and also, like, all the celebrity crossover and dating.
Yeah, I have a rule with my wife that if she, like, likes sports but doesn't follow it, you know? Uh-huh. And we have a rule that if there's, like, a game that I really want to watch, if I can convince her of the storylines beforehand, then she'll watch with me. And she's super into it. But I need, like, a half an hour to break down all the different things that are going on and, like, who the underdog is and why, like, that guy's been being a jerk to that guy and, like, this is his redemption game and yada, yada. And if I can, like, hook her, then she's in and she watches with me.
That's a really good rule.
Yeah, it's great. But then she's super invested. Like, she roots incredibly hard for whoever I've, like, set up as the protagonist.
So you can kind of, like, control the narrative and yeah. And use that as a means of, like, watching whatever you want.
But it has to be a really good story. It takes time. Like, I have to think about it. I have to prep. If I fail, if she's like, ah, I don't know. I don't care.
Then what do you watch?
Whatever she wants to watch, I guess.
Well, you actually brought us a clip.
I did. I felt like when you asked me to do this, I was very honored.
Uh-huh.
And very excited.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
And I didn't know whether like I brought clips or not. But I was like, if in the event that I bring a clip, I feel like it would be disingenuous for me to bring anything other than a Bill Simmons clip. Because I've been listening to Bill Simmons' podcast. When did it start? Like 2008? I think that in like our little world mm-hmm. where people talk about podcasts and everyone's like listening to the new podcast and stuff, mm-hmm. I think that Bill Simmons is underrated.
Really?
Yeah. When was the last time someone was like, you know who's a really good podcast host? Bill Simmons.
But people love him. Like, not just like people who talk about podcasts, but people who listen to podcasts love him. Those are sometimes I think they're like two different groups of people. People who talk about podcasts and people who like listen to them.
Definitely people who listen to podcasts love him. He has an insanely popular podcast that's listened to by tons and tons of people, including lots of people I know who kind of like sometimes don't even cop to listening to it. I think he is really, really good at hosting a podcast. I think he is sneaky good, and he does it so effortlessly that people don't give him shine for it.
What do you think makes a good podcast host?
Part of what makes a good podcast host is getting people relaxed enough that they can have an honest conversation, but also keeping it going. And I think he's really good at that. Like, he brings people on. Some of them are like foils for him, and they just kind of like allow him to like riff on what he cares about. Mm-hmm. He's good with big guests, I think. And he also doesn't do this thing, which has now become like what people think of with podcasts a lot, is like, you know, he doesn't do the kind of like big emotional crescendo interview. He shoots the shit, you know?
Yeah.
And like those shows are so lightly edited. You know, there's not like a massive team of people who then go into post-production for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Like they get them up in 20 minutes.
Well, I'm excited to hear it.
The thing about Simmons is like, he's very comfortable. It's very tough to throw him. But this moment that I wanted to play for you, he actually gets like a little thrown. So, Brittany, you don't follow sports very much. Mm-mm. But they're talking about a guy named Joe Lacob, who's the owner of the Golden State Warriors. Have you heard anything about the season they just had?
Okay.
This is not a like, pop quiz. I can just tell you. I know
so
the answer.
I know about Steph Curry. He's on the Golden State Warriors. I know he's married to Ayesha Curry, who has her own line of olive oil.
That's true. Steph Curry.
Yes.
And his teammates just won more basketball games in a season than any team in history.
Wait. They beat the Bulls. They beat the Bulls' former record, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
See?
A record that no one, including Bill Simmons, thought would ever be beat.
Oh.
And there was this profile about the owner of that team, Joe Lacob, in the New York Times Magazine, in which basically he's like taking credit for the season they just had. In this clip, Simmons... That's who you're going to hear first. Mm-hmm. He's talking with Chuck Klosterman.
Oh, the writer.
The writer, who is like a recurring guest.
Mm-hmm.
And he and Klosterman are talking about Joe Lacob, who's like a VC guy.
I really honestly feel like he violated some karma rules. Like when it's really the hot blackjack table thing, right? If you're winning money at a blackjack table and you're just raking it in hand after hand, don't talk about how great you are at blackjack. Just don't do it.
I gotta ask you one question quick, though. Yeah. I saw you kind of posted that on Twitter, and you've just said it now. I'm curious.
Yeah.
So when you talk about like things like karma,
yeah.
Is that sort of your media take, or do you actually believe
it? I actually believe it. No, I genuinely believe it.
So you believe
it. Really
okay. So what is your belief system then? Like, are you a spiritual
person? Oh, this is good.
Person?
I like when you... No, it's weird. I am a little spiritual with stuff like this. I guess I am, because I'm not religious. But I think it's bad form. Well, first of all,
no, it's definitely bad form.
I think humility is a good thing.
What you're actually saying is that you're saying that there is that in some ways he intangibly has put the team at risk of winning the title.
I do. I feel that way. Does that make me a crazy person? I honestly feel that way.
Well, I'm not going to say it makes you a crazy person, but I'm wondering what makes you think that. Like, have you had experiences in your life that have validated this? Do you just feel like the universe must work this way? It only seems reasonable that doing something negative will bring negativity. Are you kind of like, do you believe like in crystals and shit like that? Like, would you
no.
like, or like feng? How about feng shui and like the way your house is designed? Do you believe in that?
No, I don't believe in that.
But do you read your horoscope?
No. But I do.
Ever.
That the horoscope thing scares me, though. It scares me that people born in different months have the same characteristics. Like, people have guessed that I'm a Libra, and that scares me. I don't understand that whole thing. And then you get to the Chinese New Year stuff. That's also frightening to me. So I stay away from all that stuff. Psychics, stay away. I don't pray.
Ever.
I don't pray. But
even
I do.
When the Giants were driving against the Pats in that Super Bowl.
No. Who am I praying to? God's got to have better things going on than that.
But yet you believe that there's some force that's interested in NBA ownership and how he's a guy acts to newspaper reporters. You think that has a consequence. So, I mean, that's what the thing is. It's a, you know, when people talk about God, they'll be like, you know, be like, they'll be mad. They'll be, you know, why would God care about who wins this NBA game, or why would God care about, like, my drives my wife crazy when someone on Survivor will thank God, and she's like, why would God possibly care about Survivor?
Well, I never know.
If you believe in a conventional God, I mean, he kind of cares about everything, right? Equally. He has unlimited bandwidth to care. So you could do this, but, I mean, also praying for a team would essentially mean you're praying against a team in a weird way.
Maybe this is all being shaped by all the experiences I've had watching sports and gambling and casinos, and it's not rational at all.
It's rare that he like gets kind of thrown like that and is like, huh, what do I believe? You don't hear that very often.
No, I like that a lot. It was about sports, but it wasn't about sports.
If your basketball team that you happen to own because you're a gajillionaire mm-hmm. is playing really well, don't go get the New York Times to write about how that's your deal, even if you don't believe in God necessarily.
I have like a friend who doesn't believe in God, but she does definitely believe in horoscopes and like anything mystical.
I used to do a thing when I was a little kid where whenever I was like shooting baskets by myself, mm-hmm. I'd be like, if I make this one, Betsy is gonna go out with me. And then I'd miss and I'd be like, it wasn't that one. It's actually this one. So I think I believe in that stuff too.
Yeah, no, I know that I kind of do. Every once in a while, like, I'll be on the train on, like, maybe a Sunday morning. Maybe I'll be, like, hungover or something like that. And then I'll just be like, why do you hope for anything? Who's in control of any of this? Why do you think God cares specifically about you? Why do people suffer?
Like, on the train, you'll think that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, like, I feel like the train is, like, a place where I end up, like, considering a lot of my life's choices.
Sounds like you feel very differently on the train than you do at airports.
Yes, trains are where I contemplate life, and airports are for listening to long form. Well, Max, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
This is like a sampler bucket list box checked.
Wow, this is also my sampler bucket list. This is it. This is my dream.
Oh, to come on?
Yeah, this is it. If I was going to do sampler, this is how I want it to go.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm glad. I'm glad that we were able to fulfill your fantasies.
This is it.
No one, I had my best friend on this show. No one, my mom's been on this show. No one's ever said that to me. So I'll take that. I cherish it.
I'm here for you.
Thank you so much.
It is weird to not be the one asking the questions. I'll tell you that.
What's weird about it?
I'm just not used to it. Like, I'm not, like, there have been a couple of moments where you've been like, now it's your turn. This is where you talk for a while, and then I'll ask you a follow-up question.
To recap the clips that we've heard on today's show, Kevin Heldman's experience in journalism was from What the Hell Happened in East New York. The adoption story came from Modern Love. And Dee Brown's famous dunk was from the ESPN podcast Dunkumentaries. The clip that Max brought for us about spirituality and superstition in sports was from the Bill Simmons podcast. Stay tuned after the credits for a taste of what we are sampling next week. This episode was produced by Rose Reed, Sarah Abdurrahman, and myself, with help from Kate Parkinson Morgan. It was edited by Annie Rose Strasser. Our theme music was made by Mike Avellian, and our ad music was made by Mark Phillips. Additional music in the show was by Kobe Bienert. The show was mixed by Matthew Bold. Sampler is a production of Gimlet Media. Next week on Sampler, we enter into the world of oversharing, and things get kind of sexy, or just plain awkward, when I talk to the host of the show, My Dad Wrote a Porno. One of my favorite things that actually I've heard on the show.
Oh, yeah. Come on.
Was it breasts that hung like pomegranates?
Yeah, the pomegranates line. Yeah, that one's a favorite.